Shattering Myths, a program devoted to those of you who have come to realize that there's something dreadfully wrong with the political and religious institutions which govern and influence our nation, who are not celebrating today as part of the elections that took place yesterday, and who recognize the considerable malfeasance inherent in the media, the military, and with global economic influences. We've all come to realize that these institutions are the problem, which means they cannot be repopulated to provide a solution. Therefore, our mission is to look behind the headlines so that we come to know who is perpetrating the tragedies that are besieging our planet, because based upon this plague of adverse political, religious, military, and economic influences, we have at most 15 years until all hell is unleashed and a complete economic collapse, world war, unrelenting propaganda, and the deaths of billions is going to be experienced. As a result, in our second hour, we're going to engage God on His terms through evidence and reason, since His guidance regarding His covenant provides the only escape from this tragedy. Our phone number, if you'd like to participate in the in this discussion, it's toll free. It's 877-300-7645. I'd like to begin where the news ended. There was a report of the federal government imposing new flight training rules on the pilots. I suppose this is because of the flight inbound to San Francisco, whereby the pilots were unfamiliar with how to do a visual approach and got too low and too slow. I am a pilot. I have a airline transport pilot's license, which is the highest certificate that you can earn. I am type rated to fly jets as a single pilot. And I can tell you that while private pilots learn, that's the first certificate one can hold, well, student pilot and then private pilot, but as you are a student pilot trying to earn your private pilot's license, you learn how to stall and recover from a stall of an aircraft long before you even learn how to land it. And so stalling and recovering from stalls is very common practice. But little airplanes are designed specifically to be able to stall without great upheaval, and they are dynamically stable, which means that once in a stall, so long as you apply appropriate rudder and elevator and aileron and power inputs, you can very easily recover through pitch, through roll, and through power. That is not the case with most high-performance aircraft, particularly airliners. Many aircraft that are designed to be flown at high speed have swept wings. They do not have the kind of dihedral that promotes dynamic stability. A airplane that does not have dynamic stability, for example, in an oscillation, the oscillations will increase rather than decrease. And many have high tails, which is ideal for many flight conditions, but not ideal in a stall. And they're specifically designed so that the pilots will never stall them, because a stall becomes irrecoverable. For many years, about 10 years, I was the pilot of a Pilatus PC-12, a really nice airplane made in Switzerland. But the airplane had, like many T-tailed airplanes, a bad characteristic of stall, which is that if it stalled, which means that there was not sufficient lift because of your angle of attack and of the airplane, you went to knife edge, which means one of the wings went directly vertical vertical with the plane of the earth, and that the airplane pitched over and became a lawn dart. Dangerous. Yeah, the stalls were essentially unrecoverable in the aircraft, which means that there was no, you did not stall the airplane as you would a smaller aircraft and practice stall recovery. There was a stall warnings in the airplane in addition to the stall horn, but also a shaker of the yoke, which it just vibrates, would tell you you're about ready to stall. You had better add power, change your pitch, and roll out of a turn if you're in one. To recover before you enter this stall, and a Pilatus, there was also a pusher, which automatically pushed the nose of the airplane down to increase airspeed and thus remedy an impending stall. But, you know, as you move up an aircraft and you're talking about commercial aircraft jets, they don't practice stalls in jets. You know, this idea that you're going to practice stalls is craziness. It, and most of the time when a sophisticated large commercial airliner or commercial aircraft is stalled, they're typically stalled during landing. You know, flaps are out. The airplane is slower. Your rate of descent is on instrument approaches is typically a 2% grade. It's a very gradual grade. You're trying to hit a reference speed, and it's if you make a turn or you pull up inappropriately or you pull back power too soon or don't anticipate your speed declining and don't add power in anticipation of that, recognizing that a jet engine, it's about 5 seconds from the time you add power to the time that you see the full benefit of that power. There's a lag that the airplane's going to stall. And if it stalls, you don't have the altitude or airspeed or opportunity to recover because you're very close to the ground. And so this is not something that can be practiced. It reminds me of so many things that the federal government gets involved in, that it recommends doing things that are not conducive to safety because the government itself doesn't know what it's doing. You know, all the pilots of the aircraft that, I think it was a Korean airliner, that failed in San Francisco needed, and by the way, their certification was provided in Korea, so our Americans' change in training would have no influence on them, but what they needed to do was practice visual approaches. They were so accustomed to having the autopilot auto-land the airplane based upon the ILS instrument landing system, which coordinated the glide slope and glide path, and flying an airplane that had auto throttles that were linked into the autopilot system. All the pilots had to do was monitor the systems. But the ILS was inoperative at San Francisco, and so the pilots were cleared for a visual approach, something that they did not practice routinely, and they failed in their visual approach. That is why that airplane crashed. But as you will see and have heard, that is not the government's solution. Almost everything government does when it interferes in the private aspects of the economy, it does more harm than good. You know, there's a reason that America's aircraft manufacturing business is so dismal, and that most private aircraft manufacturers have been driven out of business, because the regulations imposed by the FAA are way too expensive. They're just too stringent. You know, I have an airplane currently that I've changed charter companies, and it was under a 135, which is a commercial certificate by one charter company, simply wanted to move the aircraft to a different charter company. The FISDO, the FAA FISDO, a district office that inspected the plane now a second time. This is a different FISDO than put it on charter with one company now and with the second company, has found issues that precluded them providing the charter certificate and declaring the airplane unairworthy and kept it from flying for a better part of 6 months. It's just now, after considerable expense, is flying again, all because of the FAA. So it is a real frustration when you're dealing with government regulations, and how in so many cases mountains are made of molehills, where a non-problem is made to be catastrophic, precluding the opportunity to conduct business. Now, speaking of a catastrophic aspect of our economic reach in this country that is not conducive to business, we have the Federal Reserve. We talked about a little about this in yesterday's program, but I wanted to share the full scope of what Reuters was reporting in terms of the most recent round of what's called quantitative easing. The article reads, the Federal Reserve extended its support for a soft U.S. economy on Wednesday. Soft means that we're still in the recession, sounding a bit less optimistic about growth as it announced plans to keep buying $85 billion in bonds per month. Now, I did the math for our audience yesterday. $85 billion per month times 12 months is $1 trillion a year. So the Federal Reserve is buying $1 trillion worth of bonds and bills and notes each year. Now, it's been doing that since 2008, and each time it ups the ante and buys more because the previous exercise failed to deliver the proper results. It failed to stimulate the economy. Now, in psychiatric terms, they say that someone who continues to engage in the same behavior, expecting a different result, is insane. What does that say about the Federal Reserve? Now, the Fed, or any central bank for that matter, and by central bank, do not think for a moment that the Federal Reserve is part of the U.S. government. It is not, but it is a central bank. Enacts quantitative easing by creating money, just changing a decimal point, a little malfeasance here and there in the computer system, by creating money and then buying bonds or other financial assets from banks with the money it has created. Now, if you go out, ladies and gentlemen, and create money and try to buy something with that money you created, you're going to spend a great deal of time in prison. But activities that we view as illegal in business have become legal for government and for those who work with government. Yes, indeed. What the Fed does would be considered a crime if you were an individual. And by the way, they're not part of the federal government, so this is a private business, a private monopoly, and they make up money to buy things. If you make up money to buy things, you're going to go to prison, just like the federal government's health care, Medicare plans, Medicaid, and Social Security. They're Ponzi schemes. If you were in privately participate in a Ponzi scheme, you're going to jail, but the government can do it. If you shake people down for money and force them to pay you, promising collective services to the community in return, like the mafia used to do, the mob used to do, maybe still does, and now it's been passed on to the Crips and the Blood in gangland America. But if you do that as a private citizen, you go to prison. But if you're conduct armed robbery, and that's what taxation is, if you don't pay your taxes, see if you don't go off to jail with somebody that is armed, it's considered fine for government to commit armed robbery, but you can't do it privately. But the problem with all of this is that with what the Fed is doing, when it buys, for example, bonds, the notion is that the banks then are more liquid, their balance sheets are better, and that the banks now have more cash available to loan. But they're not loaning it. In fact, what little is going out is buying treasury bills, which is keeping the interest on treasury bills artificially low. Now, that's how the idea is supposed to work, but in practice it doesn't. Banks don't have to loan out the excess cash. As a matter of fact, when it comes to home loans, the federal government has, the Obama administration has established legislation that says that if banks loan money to somebody who is not properly qualified, that they're going to impose large fines. As a matter of fact, they have been fining every manner of financial institution, eliciting billions of dollars in settlements since 2008, but they haven't defined what is considered to be an inappropriate loan. And so banks are simply not loaning money. I mean, and unless when you're trying to buy a home, you can put down now 40 or 50% and show that you make enough income to cover the loan many times over in the monthly payments, and that you work for a company that is by a gold standard in terms of an employee or employer and not for yourself, you can't get a loan. So the housing market stays depressed because of government interference. So banks today, because of these government regulations and because of the realization that the economy is so anemic, lack the confidence to offer loans, and because the federal government is competing with businesses for loans, the financial crisis that was started based upon improper mortgage loans in 2008 continues. So the Fed tries to stimulate growth by creating money out of thin air, devaluing the currency, and buying its own, the nation's treasury bonds, and buying mortgage-backed securities from banks. It has done so consistently through 2008 to the tune of about $5 trillion, and yet it continues to fail. In the midst of the 2008 financial crisis, slow growth and high unemployment, now this article said forced the Fed, didn't force the Fed, caused the Fed to, or the Fed decided to stimulate the economy through its policy of quantitative easing. But it wasn't forced to do so. It made this decision. Why? Because it makes a fortune in doing so. And it made it possible for a bankrupt nation to service its debt at least temporarily. And it made for a nation suffering gargantuan deficits over $1 trillion annually to keep interest rates on its treasuries artificially low so that interest didn't add another $1 trillion annually to the deficit, taking deficits from $1 trillion to $2 trillion. Which is what the interest rates would have done had the Fed not intervened to create money to buy these treasuries. Now you say, well, that's a pretty good scheme. You save the federal government and thus the taxpayers $1 trillion a year. But the problem is that when you create money out of nothing, you devalue money. And when you devalue the money, you are devaluing the savings and assets and homes and everything that Americans have worked so hard to be able to own and enjoy. And so you punish savings, you punish success, you punish home ownership when you do so. Speaking of insane, when the world came to recognize that quantitative easing, as it was deployed in 2008, had no influence whatsoever other than to devalue America's currency, and therefore to devalue the assets of every American, the Fed announced an expansion of the program from an initial $600 billion to $1.5 trillion on March 18th of 2009. However, immediately after that program wrapped up, growth actually slowed, and therefore the Fed, recognizing that the first tranche of $600 billion had failed, and the second tranche of $600 billion had failed, the Fed moved to a new round of quantitative easing, which it called QE2, and it purchased $600 billion worth of short-term bonds with money it had conceived out of thin air. This program, which the chairman, Ben Bernanke, first hinted at in August of 2010, ran from November of 2010 through June of 2011. QE2 sparked a rally in the financial markets, yes, but did little else to spur economic growth. You know, the rally in the financial markets is not a sign of success. All stocks are valued in dollars. When you devalue the dollar by creating more dollars out of thin air, what you do is you artificially require more dollars to be ascribed to any particular asset for that asset to be worth the same. For example, if you lose gold as a standard, the same amount of gold that was required to buy a toga and a nice pair of sandals during the time of the Roman Republic, that same amount of gold will buy a nice suit and a pair of shoes today. The value of the clothing and shoes has not changed. But if you look at in dollars, just over the last 100 years, to buy a nice suit and a pair of shoes, it's changed some 20 times. It takes 20 times more dollars to buy a suit and a pair of shoes today than it did 100 years ago. Not because the value of the suit or shoes has changed, but because the value of the dollars has been destroyed by the Federal Reserve. This is true of everything, including the stocks. So as the government, as the Federal Reserve, I should say, inflated the money supply, the prices of the stocks were inflated, not because their values had gone up, but because the value of the money had gone down. On September 13th of 2012, the U.S. Federal Reserve launched its third round of quantitative easing. QE3, we'll call it. In addition, the Fed officially stated for the first time that it would keep short-term interest rates low through 2015. They do so, particularly on treasuries, by using the creation of money out of nothing to buy treasuries so that they don't have to shop those treasuries amongst countries that know that they are underpriced based upon the risk of the United States going bankrupt. You know, when our debt, which is now over $17 trillion, to GDP ratio, which are gross domestic products, a little over $15 billion. So we owe more in total aggregate debt than the gross production of the country for a year, which is unsustainable. What that means is that any bill or bond that is offered by the government to finance new debt ought to be priced at an interest rate commensurate with the risk associated with that, and also with the realization that when the government prints money, the value, that the money that will be used to repay that bill in 5 years or 10 years will be so destroyed by the creation of new money, like quantitative easing does by necessity, that unless the interest rates are in excess of the devaluation of the currency, you'd have to be a nincompoop to buy the treasury notes. Therefore, the Fed is creating money out of nothing to buy these notes because it can't find anybody to buy them at the resulting interest rates. It's a shell game, but there's nothing under any one of the shells. It's all an illusion. And ultimately, economies can't exist on illusion. They have to be fueled by something real, by something tangible. And this whole quantitative easing experiment with fiat money isn't real. It's guaranteed to collapse. Now, I can't tell you if this whole shell game is going to, this illusion is going to collapse and that the wizard is going to be seen behind the curtain and exposed within 5 years, within 10 years, or within 15 years. But I can tell you for certain that within 20 years, it's all over. And chances are it's all over within 10 to 15 years. And there is this tendency among people to get comfortable with the normal. that, okay, things have been gradually deteriorating, but this is just the new normal. And they can't imagine that they could wake up one day and their savings would be stolen by the government. But that's what happened in Cyprus. It's what's going to happen here in America. It's what's going to happen in Europe. They can't imagine that because they haven't experienced it. They can't imagine a police state. But when you saw what happened in Boston, when you had one unarmed boy hiding, bleeding in the back of a plastic boat, and you had the entire city turned into a police state, that's what's going to happen here. People can't imagine it because they've only seen it for small periods and in selected places. But that's what's going to happen here. And it's going to be complete economic collapse. And so just because people can't imagine that occurring, they continue with the status quo. It was astonishing to me to learn last night that about 45 to 46% of Americans are supportive of Obamacare, of the Affordable Care Act, even though it is extraordinarily destructive to the little shred of power that the economy still has. And it's the single most expensive entitlement program that's ever been conceived. At a time when Medicaid and Medicare are the single biggest burdens on America and the fastest growing burden on America, that burden has been radically exacerbated. And 45% are so immoral, so irrational, so poorly informed, so grotesque in their perspective that they think it's appropriate for the government to provide for every imaginable health care need they could ever have. It's not a privilege, it's their right. Their retirement isn't a privilege, it's their right. They didn't pay for it, they didn't contribute to it, but nonetheless it's their right, and they will continue to vote that way to punish success and reward their failure. You know, and it's interesting, too, it's a slight departure from this, but I read yesterday where a report has come out that says that poor families, that would be any family of with husband, wife, two children, a nuclear family making less than about $47,000 or $48,000 a year, that four out of every five, or it's five out of every six, but somewhere in the 80% range of children from poor families fail universally in all manner of educational testing. They fail mathematically. They fail in reading comprehension. They fail in the ability to write. Every measure that is out there now to ascertain a student's ability to learn and comprehend information, 80% of children from poor families fail. And so you have to ask yourself, since the great society and this wealth redistribution process of America has all been designed to take money from those who are productive and give it to those who are not productive, and that disproportionate amounts of money are pushed into inner cities and into poor areas, redistributed into poor areas to lift up the disadvantaged. Why is it so desperately wrong? Why is it failing so miserably? My conclusion, I'm sure, is quite different than the liberal conclusion promoted in academia. It's not a matter of money. It's a matter of attitude. If you don't work, if you don't value work, if you don't know that there is something good about making a contribution, about making a sacrifice on behalf of your family, if you don't value that, if you think that you're entitled and other people ought to give you food stamps or welfare or retirement payments or your medical bills paid for nothing, the attitude that you ought to get something for nothing is eminently destructive. And that attitude is then conveyed to the children who aren't willing to invest in their education. Those children aren't born genetically so that their minds are less capable than someone who is born into a family that values work, that's willing to make sacrifices, that's willing to pay their own way. They're genetically not predisposed to be different, but it's the attitude that's different. Their parents think that they're entitled, and therefore they don't make the sacrifice that is necessary. They don't invest what is required, the effort to earn or to learn. And so the children don't either. So if you go to school and you're the attitude expressed by your parents is that someone else is responsible for me, someone else is going to give me what I need, someone else is going to provide for my health care, they're going to provide for my retirement, they're going to provide our food, they're going to provide for our shelter, and that we don't have to do anything, you're not going to do anything and you're not going to learn. But this notion of the Federal Reserve creating money out of nothing to artificially stimulate the economy as opposed to conceiving a situation where businesses have the opportunity to thrive, which would actually build an economy as opposed to destroying it, we seem incapable of making those choices. And largely because we have a population now where a disproportionate number of people have become grotesquely immoral. And they think that they are entitled to things that they want other people to pay for. This is Shattering This. We'll be back after the commercial break. Now we're talking about that mentality that's associated with being willing to invest the time to learn. You know, since I retired from my last job, I invest 10 hours a day, 6 days a week studying Yah's testimony or studying the news so that I'm in a position to be able to do this program. I invest the time. It's not a burden. I actually enjoy doing so. There's a lot of rewards for doing so. It's the nature of most things that if you are willing to invest the effort, there's a benefit associated with doing so. When the U.S. government, in collusion with the Federal Reserve, created the Great Depression, the solution became both the Federal Reserve that and the federal government intervention into people's lives. So, I mean, that was the whole purpose of creating the Depression in the first place, is to diminish the influence of business and personal liberty, and to maximize the intrusion of government and the scope of the Federal Reserve. Well, initially, FDR's programs had, at least there was some sensibility, and there's no sensibility to Social Security because it was nothing but a Ponzi scheme. You know, the first people that received benefits put in nothing to the system. And even today, it's a Ponzi scheme. But at least with the work programs, you just weren't given money. You went out and you built parks, you built dams, you built things. You know, you were engaged in work and you received money for work. But what did the liberals do? They continued to provide ever more money, but no work. And it was a welfare recipient in California, where 30% of the nation's welfare recipients now reside. You get paid more by the government than if you worked at a job 40 hours a week and earn $21 an hour. We're conditioning people to be dependent. It doesn't work. It is awesomely destructive, which is why 80% of the children who are raised in such families fail, making them dependent. And we're breeding dependent generations. And now it's the majority of Americans who are net parasites on the government as opposed to contributors to the economy. U.S. private sector employees hired the fewest workers in 6 months in October, while tepid domestic demand kept inflation benign last month, suggesting the economy was in still need of stimulus from the Federal Reserve. It's a really interesting period. The Federal Reserve stimulus have proven to be completely and totally useless. And thus far, they've stimulated the economy with about $5 trillion, has had no result whatsoever. You know, this giving the drug addicted economy more drugs has not worked. Now, typically, if you're going to inflate the money supply to this degree and devalue the currency, you would see inflation pervasive in the society. But the economy is so depressed because it was destroyed at one of the very few things that America does well now, which is in the support, the building and support of homes, that loans for homes have never been reestablished properly. That the economy is still in its doldrums, and because it's in its doldrums, there is no inflation. So here you're destroying the value of the currency, and yet there's no significant inflation to go along with it. It's a mess unlike anything that has previously existed, and it's all part of the illusion. And in the midst of all of this, private sector employers and employees, which is the only real contribution to the economy, it's just not happening. Matter of fact, enormous numbers of people, as a direct result of Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, are either laying off employees or offering them fewer hours. But this is the way that the federal government is going about it. You know, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were government corporations. They are now suing 9 of the world's largest banks on Thursday, accusing them of colluding to manipulate interest rates and seeking more than $800 million in damages. You know, the U.S. government has sued investment banks. It has sued standard banks. It has sued mortgage providers. It has sued everybody under the sun. And you can't fight the government when it sues you because they control the system. They game the system. It's the old line, you can't fight City Hall. Well, this is not City Hall. This is a national regime which is impossible to fight. And so they're collecting billions upon billions of dollars from industry, accusing industry of all sorts of malfeasance that the government stipulated.